Good afternoon, Bay Area. Welcome to the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darden, where every week we tap into the Bay Area art scene and bring you rich conversations with artists. On today's show, we take you to Books, Inc. in Alameda, where I interviewed Oakland poet James Cagney about his latest book, Ghetto Koans, A Personal Archive. In these poems, James invites readers to see life in the inner city through his poetic lens. Then we re-air an interview where James discusses Black manhood and loneliness. Today's show is about ghetto life, Blackness in the Bay, and belonging. That's all coming up. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darden, right here on KALW 91.7 FM. The first time I heard of the word koan is when I bought a copy of the poetry collection Ghetto Koans, A Personal Archive by James Cagney. Koan is a Japanese word for a paradox or riddle that can't be solved. Koans are used to train Zen Buddhists to release dependence on reason and gain spiritual enlightenment. So what do koans have to do with the ghetto? James Cagney is from Oakland. His collection is in part about the mystery, the magic, and the absurd that comes with living in the ghetto. And as someone who grew up in the inner city, the poems resonated with me. James Cagney is the winner of a Penn Oakland Award and a James Laughlin Award, and he's a Cave Canem Fellow. I interviewed him in front of a live audience at Books, Inc. in Alameda in January of 2026. We had a few technical issues, so I apologize that you may hear a little static during a few parts of the interview. Our event begins with a few words and poetry from the store's events coordinator, Jerry Thompson.
Well, welcome, everyone. This is the first installment of the Book of Light Poetry series for the new year. It's a series that I started about 2.5 years ago, and it's to play homage to the work and life of Lucille Clifton, who's a beloved poet in the Bay Area. She taught at St. Mary's, and she was my mentor and personal friend. And on the commemoration of the 25th anniversary of her book called The Book of Light, I wanted to pay homage to that. And so that's the name of the series. James, he's kicking it off for us this new season, and I couldn't be happier. I have a few things I want to share, because with the new book, James gives homage to one of our favorite local poets, Reginald Lockett, and it just ties right in with the reason why we named the series The Book of Light, paying homage to those who paved the way for us initially, and how we're giving tribute to them now. Tonight, James is here with Janae Darden, who's a superstar on KELW, Sights and Sounds Show, and she will be chatting with James, celebrating his new book, Ghetto Koans. I decided to do a little intro poem that wraps the history of all three of us and of everyone who lives in Oakland tonight. Let's see here. James is an award-winning poet born and raised in Oakland. He's here to celebrate the third collection, Ghetto Koans, A Personal Archive. If you have not already grabbed a copy, we have a few in the store. You must, and I'm sure you will before the end of the night. Janae Darden is an award-winning journalist, poet, and acclaimed host of the Sights and Sounds on KELW. You know, my radio station in my house, I keep that station on KELW all night. I don't turn it off, waiting to hear her voice. So the poem goes like this. It's called History Lessons, and I borrow lines from Janae's book of poems, James' book, and some other ingredients that connect us all. Gold flip-flops and sunflower seeds, a storm of sun, a storm of salt shaken from the sky, our skin mingled in every element. This is for Reginald Lockett. This is for Janae Darden. This is for James Cagney. Three black men spooned from the same bowl in a soul sister with a purple rose blooms. West Oakland and 40th. Am I trying to say something about paychecks and balances? Or are these ideas of home and home-brewed holy water? Oakland, between here and silent prayers and a little piece of heaven, checklist for Reginald Lockett, for Janae Darden. This is for James Cagney. Let's give him a round of applause.
Thank you so much, Jerry. That was so sweet. I'm always excited when Jerry got a poem because I know he's gonna bring it. Good evening, everybody. Yeah, thanks for coming out. I'm so happy that you all are here. Thank you so much for coming to support this great writer, James Cagney. I'm so happy you're here. I'm so happy to get to chat with you.
I'm honored. Thank you for that, Janae. Thank you.
So what happened, let me tell you why James wrote this book. I called James one day and I said, James, I don't know if you remember this. I said, James, I was like, you should write a book about the ghetto. And then you were like, your wish is my command. He's laughing. And you were like, your wish is my command because the book is coming out in like several months. So I would like to take credit that I'm the inspiration.
Sorry, because of the publishing thing, I missed putting your name in it.
Yeah, I know. That's okay. I know I looked for the thank yous. I didn't see my name on it, but that's okay. But that's why this book exists. But so James and I are friends. And I remember, like, I heard James read the first time. I was like, wow. I was like, he's such a great writer. And then after a few other times, I think it was when you wrote a poem about a moldy olive. And I was like, I don't know anybody who could write a poem about an olive that's molding and it sounds good. And so after that, I was like, he has to be my friend. And so I was like, and then I asked James to go to a concert. And I don't know if he thought I was hitting on him, but I was like, I just wanted to be James Fricks. I just thought he was so awesome. So I'm glad we're friends.
I am too.
And that is not why he is here today, because he's an awesome poet. Definitely one of my favorite poets in the Bay Area. And so Ghetto Koans is a vibe. It's a mood. It's a testament. It's sometimes it feels like, what's the word I'm looking for? It's mourning too as well. You know, eulogy sometimes.
Sure.
Yeah, it's all different types of emotions. So I want you to read one of the first poems on page 2, because I feel like this sets the tone for the book. And this is the Let Me Holler At You.
Indeed. Let me holler at you. This city is in between cities right now. This city with dirty streets like collapsed arteries. This city is going through some things and just can't and might have to be put down. This city is where the rich compete in buildings, tagging territories with titanium graffiti. God being a poor man's investment, this city keeps its churches locked, open by request for those who tithe more than used needles. This city closed its homeless shelters for lack of corporate sponsors. At last night's news conference, the mayor broke out in tears after someone stole the catalytic converter out of her limo. She admitted, the game has been rigged for decades, but it's over now, baby. A skyline of empty buildings, fish tanks souped with dead mollies. The sunset sticks its fangs into skyscrapers and sucks out the staph infection. From 98 floors up, the homeless smell fine. Drug addicts can't be recognized, crawling like ants to shoot up in the lobbies of buildings named after their grandparents. Half the unhoused and heroin microsleep own the properties where they're hosed off the entryway. This city is a dystopian movie set and scaring the neighborhood, the neighbor's ginger doodle. The streets walk themselves, grinding their teeth all night. The bridges are syringes, the sidewalk a belt knotted on a dead arm. This city is on the nod. This city stares at the moon, unsure of its intentions, says, don't I know you from somewhere? Says, let me hold on to a little something-something before the next eclipse. No one will look this city in the eye. This city says, everything's fine. This city will rise from the ashes of the suburbs and dance. Just you watch from the cemetery.
The visuals, as I'm reading that piece and hearing you say that piece, just the details. I love that line about the sun with the fangs, because that just speaks to kind of where we are right now in this society and just living and getting by day to day and what's going on with our cities and where people need support. And it's also too, it's also like just ironic. Like it's kind of when you, like the part about the homeless people smell fine from 98 floors up. Mm. I mean, just showing like just some of the heartlessness that's happening and that is ridiculous.
Yeah, I wrote that in a workshop back in Pittsburgh, and the people in the in my circle all thought that this was about their cities, mm-hmm. you know, Boston or whatever or wherever.
Which is interesting because that you say that because I notice each poem is there's a location that's inspired by this poem, and it's here it says City Hall, comma, and it's blank. So it could be City Hall, right? Like anywhere
exactly
in America. So Ghetto Koans, a personal archive. So break down to us, what is a koan?
Koan, as it was introduced to me, is a word puzzle. It's something that is used by Buddhist monks, people that are studying Buddhism, as a way of breaking open, as a way of finding enlightenment, mm-hmm. As a way of breaking you out of your habit of thinking or wanting to find an answer. And I was thinking really that instead that practice seems like a very sort of act of self-discovery. And I feel like the title that has stuck with me for so many years for this project feels like the poems are intended to be a discovery of your own neighborhood, a kind of like a breaking through of the idea that it is not just about you and your experience, but it's about how you bounce off the neighborhood that you are engaged in and live in.
So where does the ghetto come into that?
It brings something that could be seen as sort of I don't know, fancy, high-minded. It brings it down to earth to me. It applies, I would say, to these poems in the sense that these poems to me hit like little riddles, and maybe really all poems, all poetry is a riddle, and it's sort of like these riddles are kind of like either made available to you for some kind of like understanding, or like with most koans, it's sort of like if you don't kind of like get it, maybe that enlightenment isn't just for you. Maybe it's like the next one in the line or whatever. It's like that.
I apologize because the way I pitched this when I did the ads, the promos for the radio station, and I broke down what I thought it meant, I was wrong. I got a C-.
It's all. You know what? And
so
there's
I apologize if you came here for something that wasn't what you thought.
You know what? I'm realizing as a writer, as a poet, it's like I have to open up for other people to bring interpretations that I had not considered or thought of, and try to write open enough to where it, you know, other things that I hadn't occurred to me can be welcome into it. So that's all good.
Because I grew up in the ghetto. I grew up in East Oakland. You know, we both came from the hood. And so when I saw what a koan means, and then I tied it to the ghetto, and I was just thinking about how sometimes when you grow up in the inner city, it's just some things don't make sense. And like you said, like the riddle, some things that can't be solved. And sometimes the actions that people do may not make sense to some people, but it may make sense to us. And it's just some things are just mysterious. And I think you get when you grow up in those type of environments, speaking from my experience, there is an enlightenment that comes from it. And, you know, because like it's not even just about survival, you know, just the creativity that comes out of growing up in the ghetto. I mean, so much pop culture comes from people that live in the ghetto, right? Which is kind of a riddle, like, oh, these people are so oppressed, but they're contributing so much to this world, but they're not getting the resources that they need. And so, like, that's all that what came up for me when I'm reading that book, reading your book, yeah. And just some of the pieces. Because I'm like, sometimes I'm reading things, and I was like, some people wouldn't get this if they lived outside of the ghetto. But, you know, I do, and there's things I see. Where I'm like, you know, I was talking to somebody, we were talking about the tumbleweaves, mm-hmm. which tumbleweaves are like,
wow.
You know, like tumbleweaves are, you'll see like fake hair just in the street and it looks like a tumbleweed. And it's kind of like, where does that come from? Is it a fight? Like, right? Is it? And like one time I was in my mom's neighborhood, we saw this same ass of hair for months. Like that tumbleweed just survived for so long, you know. And so that's what I was saying, like the riddle.
Like, you know, a little bit more before this book got published. That's an awesome idea.
That's why I so excited because the way you write about the ghetto is so powerful and beautiful. And like, it just, I always say James Cagney, like, he just hits you in the stomach. So I was really excited that you wrote a book about the ghetto. How did you even find out about a koan?
I'm going to say it. At the end of the 20th century. I found myself basically orphaned. I was struggling to find, you know, a place to live and work. And it was incredibly stressful and it was incredibly bothersome and incredibly blank, add what you would like. In the midst of all of that, while I'm, you know, finally getting like an apartment where it's like, okay, I can finally be here and I get like a job that kind of like works for me. There came a time period in my life when I was like, I need to figure out how to be quiet. Mm-hmm. Conversely, I need to figure out how to be able to sit with silence and be okay with that. And I will tell you truthfully, maybe another puzzle, is that at the time I remember using some money and buying a psychic reading. And this is the only time in my life that I sent a psychic a thank you note, because what they told me about all of that stuff, because there was a recording of it that I heard, and basically almost none of it really applied to me, except that they told me that I have a very, very strong, as he defined it, clairvoyant space. And he was using that word literally as in clair, as in clear, and voyant as in vision. That it's like that for whatever reason, I see that you can see things very, very clearly and very distinctly, and I think you need meditation class. And him saying that, and then me just kind of like grabbing a bunch of books on meditation and Buddhism, that was what sort of helped me just kind of release a lot of the narrative stories that I'd been, you know, running and a lot of the grief that I'd been dealing with. And it just allowed me to just sort of finally be at peace and to just, you know, to sit with my own company and be okay with that, which, you know, can be a struggle. And I feel like that experience of learning what meditation was really helped in the writing, of course, and it was the beginning of the birth of what this project would ultimately be. It's not official, and it is in no way connected to or endorsing, you know, Buddhism or anything like that. It's like there really are no official koans in the book, period, as far as literally as I would tell you. Yet and still, I feel like all of us are given kind of like puzzles or riddles that we have to work out within our own life. And me as a writer, what I have is the things that I see, the things that I experience, and the things and the stories that stick with me that I don't know what to do with. And a lot of that energy and a lot of those images then get processed into poetry, especially if I experience something, see something, cross paths with something, and that image, that idea, that thought refuses to leave me alone. I'm like, as an artist, it feels really important to me to engage the scratches that you have subconsciously and the ideas that are given to you to deal with. I feel like that stuff is not something you should ignore. It's something that you need to, however or whatever your art is, to somehow engage some kind of courage and turn and just look at it and examine it and address it. And I guess part of some of the work that's coming out of this book and other stuff that I've done is me doing that, is thankfully maybe to that meditation, to that silence, having the courage to just be able to stop and turn and look the devil that's following me in his eye.
Wow. Excuse me. That's so powerful. I feel like, I'm like, how do I follow that? And I'm thinking too, as you're going through this process of silence, and I'm thinking of the title, Ghetto Koans. And in the ghetto, it's noisy, you know? And so even just having to just to reach a space where you can be silent, where you can sit in silence. And just even like, that's hard for a lot of people to be still. But that's amazing that's what led to this.
It is. Yeah. And I guess I'm also going to say out loud in respect to all my brothers that sometimes I find it consistently interesting that a lot of people have an issue with just being in silence.
Yeah.
And it fascinates me because I don't own a car and I'm always on the bus or whatever. And it fascinates me to be in public and to still see people carrying around radios with them continuously running. First thing in the morning or whatever's like that. And I'm like, I'm not hating on that. That's what I used to do when I was a kid. But now as an older man, I'm thinking, wow, it is really a challenge for blank you, me, to just sit quiet. And a person like myself, I want to address that or look at that.
And there's so much noise in the world, more than when you and I were coming up.
That's true.
And I remember, too, I had an ethnic studies professor, and he wrote about, he wrote about that as far as, like, people, you know, playing music loud. It's funny, because I was talking to somebody on the bus last night about that, because he had, like, a speaker that... I was like, I feel like it was going to just blow me away to the back of the bus. And I remember my professor said that sometimes people do that because they're not being heard.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes that's why they may play their music loud like that. But, you write about nostalgia in your work. This book, Other Books, so beautifully, and painfully. I'm sorry, I'm dealing with allergies, so forgive me. And I feel like you're mourning in this book, too, as well.
Looking at some of the memories of being a child and having relatives from out of town come visit, and hang out and gamble and drink and just kind of like tell story. And based on how my life has been going, it occurs to me that I don't get the opportunity to sort of sit with relatives and bat stories back and forth. And not being able to do that to me means that some stories are going to get lost. Even with my parents, it occurs to me, if I wasn't a writer, there would never be any references to either of them. And there is no proof that my parents ever existed until, something got put down or until something got said or until something got, written. And it's sort of like I wanted to give myself some kind of opportunity to run these weird little stories that are not important, but they were just sticky for me. And it's just kind of like sometimes you just want to throw your arm around someone or just sort of turn to somebody on the bus and just run this odd story or experience that you've had. And I'm like, I don't really get that. I have to take that energy and turn that into art or turn that into some kind of like work because whatever it was I saw or experienced or felt just kind of like doesn't exist. There's no way to prove anything that I've experienced or done until it gets placed in some concrete form.
I hear that because I remember growing up, talking to your grandparents and aunties and uncles and hearing the stories. Adrian, who's a poet sitting in the front row, she's from the South. I mean, that's so much Southern culture. And, our ancestors migrated here. A lot of us from the Black ancestors from the South during the Great Migration. And I feel that way, too, because I don't have children. Mm-hmm. And I can't have children. And I think about that, like, some of those stories I have, where are they going to go? And I can't pass them down. So I definitely feel that. Speaking of nostalgia, there's a poem I really like. I'd like for you to read.
Sure. I don't think you have to ask, huh?
Okay. It's on page 32.
Oh, it's on page 32.
Yeah.
I did have to ask.
And I love this poem because it takes us back to the pre-cell phone era.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's, say the title, all that jazz. Yeah, go ahead.
What zero sounds like after watching teenagers attempt to use a rotary phone. There used to be one in every house, affixed to the kitchen wall or its own end table or altar. Our bone-white phone ruled from a wire stand crammed with phone books and addresses torn from envelopes. If you remembered to clean it, You'd wipe it down like a baby. Its umbilical cord would braid itself over all the stories and lies transmitted. You'd have to stand on the dining room chair to let the long cord unkink. The handset, a satellite spinning weightless above the rug. You slow dialed if you didn't want to talk but had to. You'd listen to its metallic purr, watch the plastic wheel rotate, and as it rang, wondered what the house or room on the other end looked like. Ours would scream in our empty living room, and you'd run to it, tell it from the kitchen you were coming, even as every footfall shook the decorative plates on the walls. Sometimes, Mama could tell who was on the line just by hearing it ring. She'd say Jesus before picking it up, not because it was him calling, but rather she knew she was going to need him before she hung up. Grandpa would call every day and hold the phone. You'd stand there and listen to him breathe for a while. You had to wait, even if you knew what he wanted, and what he wanted was nothing. Just nothing. "Where your mama?" he'd finally say, his mouth echoing toothless M's. Mama would lean back on the couch, her voice in his ear, and they'd exchange breaths for the longest time. She'd sit like that for a while, smoking, her fingers turning solitaire tarot on the coffee table. Sometimes she'd lean back on the couch and I'd put my ear to her stomach, listening to what was going on in there, until she had to get up and do this or finish that. Call waiting used to be called patience. You let the phone ring, and if no one picked it up, you called right back and let it ring some more. Call forwarding was when someone would call and it wasn't for you. You'd have to go to the yard where she spray watered tomato plants, or you'd hang above the window above the driveway and shout through the bathroom door, "Phone!" It's true there was a number to call just to hear the time. Actually, it wasn't a number at all. You called popcorn. There was a number to dial for movie times. There was a number to dial for dirty whispers. There was a number to dial to hear a psychic tell you everything you didn't know about your own life. There was a number to dial to hear a joke. The joke was that that call cost $10, and there was no number to dial to get your money back. There was a number to dial to save money on a long-distance call. You had to dial another number before dialing the number you wanted to dial. Long-distance only happened Sunday nights. You sat with your parents and shouted over the whiff of states. The caller's voice so far away, they sounded otherworldly. You'd have to talk quick and with purpose, remember your report card, and ask about your cousin because time was money tumbling from someone's palm. As a teen, I could talk for hours about nothing. Or prank call. I talked with a girl once while slowly pouring water out of a gallon pitcher into the toilet. It took the longest time before she asked, "What are you doing?" "Oh, just standing here," I said. Obscene phone calls don't happen anymore. I miss them. One day, my father caught one and said, "Hold on for a minute," then passed the phone to Uncle Jerry, who had just drove 270 miles from Bakersfield. He took the phone, listened for a good while, frowned, then started cussing till black flies tumbled from his mouth. That was back when hanging up on someone really meant something.
Great piece. It just took me back in time. And some of those things you mentioned, I forgot about the number that you dialed to, like, save money, and then you dialed the number that you intended to dial. Yeah, all of that.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, even that video, because there was a video, I think, that is literally called that, is watching teenagers use a rotary phone. That video in and of itself was kind of fascinating to watch.
I saw a video with this guy where he had like a corded phone and he was making a joke about how long the cord would be. Mm-hmm. And he was like at the gym on the phone. And it was like this yellow cord, you know. He was like down the driveway, down the street. Yeah, it was funny. I love that piece. It just brought back so many memories.
Thank you. That's cool.
So you dedicated this book to the late poet, West Oakland poet, Reginald Lockett. Do you all know who Reginald Lockett is? Anybody knows? A couple people? Okay. Tell us, who is Reginald Lockett?
Reginald Lockett was a poet here from Oakland. He was, and considered himself, and probably was literally the poet laureate for West Oakland. He was a teacher and an incredibly brilliant and generous brother. He, you know, after my mom died and I was, you know, still struggling to keep things together, he actually... had me to come out to speak to one of his classes, and fed me and really looked out for me. He was always an incredibly generous and beautiful person and an extraordinary poet. And when I was putting this book together, I actually didn't have any specific person that I wanted to dedicate it to, but I was talking with a mutual friend that between. Reginald and myself, who reminded me, and I was like, you know what? This is the book that I would like to gift Reginald if he was still here. This is almost the kind of book that I would think that he possibly would have created over his time if he had still, you know, been around or whatever. He had a way of being, you know, with the people as a teacher and as a writer. And he was just a really, really beautiful person. And yeah, if anything, more than anything else, it's just an honor to be able to give a shout out to him from beyond and dedicate this project to him. Because he was a very, very special person. And I'm honored to have crossed paths with him here in Oakland.
And thank you, too, to Jerry for mentioning him in the opening poem as well. I never met him, but I know just meeting other poets in the Bay Area, he meant a lot to a lot of people. There's another poem that I like. Mm-hmm. It's about one of my favorite entertainers.
You know, it's funny. A version of this book almost came out in about 2020. And I backed out of publishing it then. And I'm glad that I did, because a couple of really important pieces developed after that time.
Yes.
And this is one of them.
Okay. Read it.
Every poem in the book, I call it's datelined to a particular place where the poem probably took place. This is a mild lie in that it is datelined for a business that does not exist any longer, but is the beauty school where my mom used to teach in the 60s or 70s. And I just wanted that place a shout out and named it. So the poem is called "Tina Turner's Wig Gives Its Final Public Address." And the dateline is Charm Beauty College, Grand Avenue, Oakland. I ain't no wig. I am a high jeweled crown, heliotrope to the spotlight. I may not have roots, but anyone can see we, all of us, are inseparable. The first compassionate partner she ever got to choose. She sat me on her knee, not like a doll, but a sister, and chanted herself empty. The care she needed, she massaged into each lock. She said, "You better be good to me." Said her real name was Anna May, then told every pebble of her story between Nutbush to Buckingham Palace. She explained I was her new legacy, shiny and divine, handcrafted, purified in ceremony, then left to dry natural. I was sewed and ruffled, back combed and teased until I could defy gravity. And how high I could rise for her. It's because of me fans recognize her before she ever opens her mouth. Everyone goes on about her insured legs. The girls, she calls them. I've heard of them. But I am her marquee. I shine like the rainbow of light God sent before swearing off more rain. Oh, my lady, how long I've been meaning to tell you. Every strand, every fiber, everything depends on love.
I love that poem. I wanted to cry and when you read it after she died. And when I saw the Tina Turner musical, and I thought of that poem when I was watching that musical. And I was just thinking about the theme of the book and how, you know, she grew up poor. You know, she kind of came from a ghetto environment, if you will. Grew up poor in the segregated South and became an international star. She became a sex symbol in her 40s. She became the queen of rock and roll, a Black woman. And then, too, just thinking of Black women in our hair, you know. And, like, that was her thing, was that wig. That wig. I mean, I remember, I was like, when I would get my hair done, my grandmother would blow dry my hair out. And my hair would be poof out over to, like, I was Tina Turner. You know, Tina Turner. So I just thought that was cool that that's in the book. And it's a shout-out to the beauty schools.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, yeah, that's a, I mean, beauty school's a big deal in Oakland back in the day.
That's true.
Yeah, because my grandmother, she was a beautician, God rest her soul. Yeah. So, yeah. So
and I know. My mom worked for a place called Althena, which I think was one of the first Black-owned beauty salons. And she ended at the Institute for Cosmetology, which used to be down across the street from where Sears used to be. Yeah, all my memories are used to be, my bad.
Well, that speaks to, like, what's going on, right? All these things, you know, these places that we grew up. I mean, those beauty colleges, that helped. My grandmother was a businesswoman. She's an entrepreneur. She had she had her hair salon in a den in the house, and sold Avon. I mean, like, those businesses fed us, paid us, you know, for us to go to school and all that kind of stuff. So it's sad that they're gone. And people are having a discussion about these blue-collar institutions that are gone, and it deprived people of not having the education or training to open their own business. Yeah, so, yeah, I love that. I loved all of that whole theme. And something else you said, too, and I know we got to wrap up soon. Yeah, something else you said, too. You mentioned about being on the bus. Mm. And I love that. I don't have a car at the moment. And so the world looks so much different. Mm. And I'm like, I've been driving, you know, as long as I can remember. Like, you know, being in the world as a passenger on the bus and on the BART, you know, it's different.
Yep.
And you see the world totally different. When you're out in the streets, it's like, you see it totally different. And you run into those people who want to tell you a story and just want to talk to you. And I get that a lot.
Right.
You know, I talk about that. People always come to me, want to talk to me just, you know, randomly. But, yeah, just the insight that you have, you know, the personal archive. How does that tie to the title of the book is Ghetto Koans, A Personal Archive. How does James Cagney walking in this world, you know, on public transportation, as a pedestrian, like, how does that play into this? Because I love how each piece is inspired by, like, a street, many of them in Oakland.
Over the years, the best and strongest education that I got as far as writing and that process was taking journalism classes in high school and then when I went to Laney. And what journalism did for me is it basically just taught me how to organize information and how to effectively get through telling a story. Yeah. That kind of writing was awesome to me. And it is a mystery upon all why I didn't choose journalism as a career path, because it was such a cool thing for me. I used the energy that I'd learned in studying journalism in the poetry. Because as a poet, I feel like I am self-taught. And I would go to the library bookstores like this and pick random poems to try to figure out what this thing was that people were doing. And organizing, it seems like I wanted to find out if there was a way to capture something that I found to be either distracting or beautiful or weird and tell it as completely straight and as honestly and truthfully as I could because of the, you know, tenets of journalism and get it mm-hmm. right. If it is possible to tell the truth in a way that's beautiful or to tell the truth in a way that is in a way that is appealing as a story and as just as an event of words on a page. You know, it's kind of like you know, it's like there's a poet that I this one of my mentors, Devorah Major.
Yes.
Who I love and honor, and who looked at me crazy when I tried to say to her about being truthful or using honesty in poetry. And she was like, poetry does not owe anybody any actual truth. You know, maybe the truth comes out of whoever reads it. Mm-hmm. And maybe my philosophy then is just a challenge for myself and just my own, you know, ignorance and development to figure out, is there a way to see an event, to see an action, to watch a leaf fall from a tree and make that interesting? Is there a way to describe a thing seen and felt and experienced that may be just sort of almost pointless? You know, it's like watching a guy drag a chihuahua on the back of a bus. Can I make that interesting as an event of words on the page, just sort of like using the honesty of what it was that I saw? And as best as I could, just kind of stay out of the way of it.
Yeah.
You know, keep my own opinions and thoughts. Is there a way I can show you this photograph in words and let that be enough? And that's kind of what my answer to your question is about. That journalism really helped focus me and my work. And I gave myself the challenge of trying to figure out, is there a way to be honest? And still be beautiful and still make a point. And I'm saying that's still something I'm studying, even as people seem to like what's coming out of the book.
Well, I noticed all of that. You know, I did think of journalism a little bit when you, as I was going through this, because we're looking at this through your eyes and you do such, you're so masterful at just taking something, again, so simple, like I mentioned earlier, a moldy olive, and just painting this amazing picture. Which also, too, just shows, like, how this, like, spectacular life can be. The simple things, the crazy things, right? Just the everyday things. So you do that beautifully and masterfully.
Thank you.
Yes. James Cagney, it has been a pleasure.
Thank you.
It has been a pleasure.
Thank you. It's so good to sit with you and talk with you.
That was poet James Cagney speaking with me at Books, Inc. in Alameda. James's book, Ghetto Koans, is published by Black Lawrence Press. Thank you to Jerry Thompson, events coordinator of Books, Inc. of Alameda, as well as the store's wonderful staff. Thanks to our KALW engineers, Gonady Joe Johnson and James Rollins, for their help. And, of course, our Sights and Sounds producer, Porfirio Rango. Thank you so much. Coming up, a throwback interview with James Cagney about Black manhood, loneliness, and belonging. Stay with us. Earlier, you heard an interview I did with poet James Cagney in front of a live audience. And I forgot to say, you're listening to the Sights and Sounds show with me, Janae Darden, on KLW 91.7 FM. Anyway, so we're going to go back in time to when I interviewed James about his 2022 book, Martian, the Saint of Loneliness. And in it, he expresses how, as a black man, the world doesn't treat him like he belongs here. So let's take a listen. In the beginning of the book, you know, the book starts off with pieces on police brutality and social injustices against black folks and people of color. Can you read a piece?
Found in America, Bad Apples. American history is the story of demonic possession, servile killers of sinister power, mass murderers divinely blessed and guided to manifest their own destiny, which involved enslaving and killing millions. Satan wears the other's face. Others have always been expendable since they stand in the way of the American God's imperial march to war. Wars sponsored and red carpeted. Wars waged over fuel and false flag operations. Most Americans write off unprecedented state terrorism as a series of aberrations carried out by bad apples. Bad apples torching cities of civilians to death with cluster bombs of napalm. Americans charbroil cities under infrared ashes and uranium tar, then go to lunch, possessed by the delusion of our own God-blessed goodness. We grew up under the bomb, under orders. Whose orders? Then discriminate against radiated ethnic children, leaving them to smolder for decades and die while we giggle-hide under desks, then wax nostalgic about black rain over mimosa brunch. For Americans, innocence is a secular faith. Brain-rattling games, our national religion. What are we really? Hyenas with polished masks, conical incisors and fangs, alternating red, white, blue. Red is blood, blood on every street corner, blood tides on the shoreline, blood in our pockets, blood on the tracks, blood on a former mother's dress, blood on her face.
This piece that you just read, I'm thinking about the theme of Martian and the title of your book, Martian, the Saint of Loneliness. You can't quite call this country home. You may not call this planet home because of the way it rejects you. Can you talk about that? I don't know if I'm kind of going along the right lines as far as the way I'm analyzing.
You're absolutely right. And I should say it was never intentional for me to name that book Martian or for that to ultimately end up being the theme to all of these pieces. That title and identity happened last after everything was done. But it felt right because both on a personal level, because I myself often feel separated, isolated. Perhaps I'm guilty of making choices that have created my life or has defined my life around that sort of isolation, but I often feel like a weirdo, like a person truly dropped here from another planet. And the resonance of being of a specific race, a race that seems to be identified and judged upon seeing me without ever hearing my voice, does make me, in some rooms, in some places, feel like I was dropped from a different planet.
And I was also thinking about other Black artists like Sun Ra and Prince because of the way you're racialized as a Black man, but also to just your brilliance and your skills.
Thank you. If I was conscious that I was in the process of writing this particular book, I would have turned more directly into writing more racially sensitive work, more poems that look directly and deeply into that sort of sense of otherness.
I noticed a theme or a few pieces in your book about having to grow up too fast and not having the privilege of boyhood that so many young Black men and Black boys don't have. And you wrote in the back of the book that by fifth grade, you had a full beard and you were paying adult bus fare. What's your thoughts about that as far as like Black men and having, you know, being able to be boys?
I felt extremely uncomfortable when puberty hit and I started to become very hairy. And my discomfort was because all of the images that I was being shown as a young man, as a boy, as a growing person, all of the images of men that were presented to me in magazines, in music videos, on television, were all guys that looked polished, that looked as sleek and as hairless as sports cars. And certainly none of the friends that I had at that time in the fifth and sixth grade, nobody was sprouting in that way. And it made me feel very, very self-conscious because, you know, I'm as a child to scan the room that you're sitting in, classroom, house full of relatives, and to not really see yourself reflect back to you as far as you can't identify someone who seems to be going through something similarly to yourself, who is also coming in with like a beard or something like that. It's sort of like, I felt like as a young boy, I was given like this gigantic egg that I somehow just had to hide, this part of myself that I didn't know how to present to the world. And what does a young person do with that sort of frustration of sort of feeling like you're almost an alien within your own body? I don't know. There was like this huge private war going on within me that I could never really talk about. And I guess that war was about what exactly is the man I am supposed to grow into? What exactly is that man supposed to be? How is that man supposed to occupy himself and occupy his space in the world? Even if that man is a Black man, even if that man looks and behaves differently from others, it's like, even if you are separated, even if you cannot be easily stirred into a particular bowl or a particular identity or a particular space, if there is no obvious box for you, you know, it's like, how do you find yourself? How do you define identity and manhood for yourself?
So I was reading in the back of your book that when you read the poem Martian, the first time you read it, you were very nervous. And so now you have this full collection of Martian, the Saint of Loneliness. How do you feel now?
I feel good and I feel excited and I feel very curious. Because all of those poems, especially the poems in the back half for, you know, Vanishing Twin Syndrome or whatnot, are so incredibly personal to me. I don't know how any of that work will sit with, you know, a stranger. And ultimately, the work that I'm trying to do as a poet is to create my best self on the page and offer that as a gift to strangers. And that is to say that a lot of my desire, a lot of whatever my projection is about the response to the book or whatever, is completely out of my hands. And I just kind of am sitting and hanging out and waiting to see what kind of response comes back to me, if anything.
That was Oakland poet James Cagney speaking with me about his 2022 award-winning poetry collection, Martian, the Saint of Loneliness. And that interview originally aired on KALW's Cross Currents. That's all the time we have for the Sights and Sounds show with me, Janae Darden. Thank you to our show producer, Porfirio Rangel, our KALW engineers, Gonady Joe Johnson and Jane Rollins, our board operator, Damian Miner, and our director of audio programming, David Boyer. And as always, thank you for tuning in. We'll have another great show for you right here next week. Until then, be good to yourselves and each other, and make sure you tell folks about the show too as well, and tell them they can listen on the NPR app or the KALW app, or they can go online at klw.org. Take care.